These recently released secret CIA UFO files indicate intense government interest in the military potential of UFOs. These files establish that the CIA had agents all around the world gathering information on UFOs. This interview with Senator Barry Goldwater provides an even clearer view of the government's concern about the military potential of UFOs. Senator Goldwater was the Republican candidate for president in 1964 and is a major general in the United States Air Force Reserve. We have verified the following quotes. Air Force, Navy, and commercial pilots have revealed to me cases when a UFO would fly near them, right off the plane's wing, and then just zoom away at incredible speeds. I asked General Curtis LeMay, who for years was head of the Strategic Air Command, for permission to check into the files, and he told me, "Hell no, and don't ask me again. I think some highly secret government UFO investigations are going on that we don't know about, and probably never will unless the Air Force discloses them. Someday soon, someone is going to have strong UFO evidence that can't be explained away." End Senator Goldwater's quote. There is already strong evidence that can't be explained away in Senator Barry Goldwater's own home state of Arizona. The evidence revolves around an incident that took place in the Sitgraves National Forest. It was in this location that a young woodcutter named Travis Walton was abducted by a UFO. The UFO was witnessed by six of his fellow workers. At Travis's home in Snowflake, Arizona, we interviewed him and one of the witnesses to the UFO, Mike Rogers.
There were seven of us on the way home from work. We were riding down a dirt road in a pickup, and we saw an object hovering off to the side of the road. It was a glowing disc-shaped object. It was about 90 feet away.
It was hovering about, I'd say, 15 to 20 feet off the ground.
I got out of the truck and went closer. I wanted to get a closer look at it.
I realized for the first time what he was doing, and I realized that it was dangerous.
I expected it to, you know, fly away when I got closer, but instead, when I got up there, it started to move and to make a loud sound, which scared me.
I yelled at him, and I told him, you know, get the hell away from there.
I raised up and turned to go.
And then all of a sudden, the object apparently blasted him with some sort of a ray or bolt of light or something.
I felt a numbing shock and lost consciousness. And that was the last I knew until I woke up aboard the craft.
When I saw this bright, blinding light, I turned back just in time to see Travis flying back through the air. He hit the ground about 10 feet or so from where he had been standing. At that point, with the blast that the saucer had given him, it was such an incredible thing. It was just unbelievable. I was in an instant panic. The guys behind me, somebody says, "Get the hell out of here." So I hit the gas, and we took off down the road.
Mike Rogers and the other five witnesses returned only to find Travis missing. After they told their astounding story to the police, they came under suspicion of murder. An intense search for Travis Walton proceeded for 3 days using a large posse, dogs, and helicopters. They were unable to find him or any signs of where he was. Finally, it was suggested that the six witnesses take a polygraph test to establish the truth or fallacy of their story.
We told them, you know, we'll take polygraph tests, we'll take sodium pentothal, hypnosis, anything you can give us, because this thing really happened, and we don't like this thing about you accusing us of murder, which several of them had openly.
Arrangements were made for Cy Gilson, a highly qualified polygraph examiner who was a member of the Arizona State Polygraph Association, to conduct the polygraphs on the six witnesses to Travis Walton's UFO encounter. The utmost care in administering these lie detector tests was exercised because the men were under suspicion of murder.
Once the tests got underway, he started changing his mind very quickly. After he had tested about three of the six, he seemed to be acting differently. By the time he had tested all of us, he seemed to be a believer. I talked to him after the tests, and he indicated to me that apparently he was wrong. Unofficially, he said that he believed that we had told the truth, because five of us passed the test. He wrote in his report that we had told the truth, that apparently there had been a UFO. This was a very emotional thing for Travis's family and emotional for us. Travis was my best friend, and our whole lives have been disrupted by this. We wondered if we would ever see him again.
When I regained consciousness, I was laying on my back. I came to slowly. I was in a lot of pain in my head and chest area. At first, I thought I was in a hospital. But when I could finally see, I saw these beings standing over me, and I just became hysterical. They were about 5 feet tall. They had no hair, no eyelashes, eyebrows, very large heads, very large eyes. The rest of their features, nose, mouth, and ears were small, and they were very white looking. I knocked them away from me, and jumped off of the table there, and they started to come toward me. I grabbed an object off of the bench there and threatened them. They stopped and turned around and left the room. I was afraid they'd come back, so I left there looking for a way out. I went into another room where there was a chair. There was some kind of a projection or some kind of a viewing thing in this room where you could see a map of the stars. A man came in while I was trying to find a way out there. And this was a human-looking person. They had passed in a crowd, this individual, and on Earth. He was bigger than me, taller, and more muscular. A very large individual. I went up and tried to talk to this guy, and he didn't answer me. He led me outside of this craft that I was in, which was apparently parked inside of a large room or a building or a larger craft, and led me out of this room into another room where some other beings like himself put me unconscious. When I regained consciousness, I found myself laying on the roadway, and I saw a craft hovering there that just sat there for a second and just shot straight up. That's the last I've seen of them. I ran down into the town there and called my family, and they came and got me.
When I did hear that he had been returned, it was almost as unbelievable as the original thing, because he had been gone so long.
One of the biggest shocks I had to deal with when I was returned was finding out that this brief period of time had somehow taken over 5 days. When I found out I'd been gone for that long, it was just, you know, blew me away. My brother, you know, told me about it, and I was stunned, and he asked me to feel my face, and I had a you know, a week's growth. And I was really took my mind just reeled at that, because as far as I knew, it was the same night. The thing that bothered me most about the whole experience was those eyes. When they looked at me, they just seemed like they were looking right through me. You just can't understand how it would be if it were just right there.
After his return, Travis Walton also passed a polygraph test, verifying the truth of his UFO experience. To obtain an expert opinion on what conclusions could be drawn from the polygraph tests in the Travis Walton case, we interviewed Edward Gelb, president of the American Polygraph Association.
Hundreds of police departments and corporations throughout the world utilize the polygraph to separate truth from deception. The 94% accuracy of the polygraph has been well documented, not only in real life situations as we've discussed here, but in laboratory and university studies that have been conducted throughout the world. The odds against six people successfully deceiving a trained polygraph examiner on a single issue are over 1,000,000 to 1.
The polygraph evidence in the Travis Walton case is strong enough to stand as proof in a court of law in many states. In order to understand where the beings that kidnapped Travis Walton may have originated, we must first understand our place in the universe. Our sun is only one of over 150 billion stars in our galaxy, the Milky Way. There are billions and billions of galaxies in the universe. If only one star in every million has planets that can support life, then there are hundreds of billions of life-supporting planets in the universe. Within 55 light years of our own solar system, there are thousands of stars. 46 of these near neighbors are similar to the sun and can be expected to have planets and life, especially if colonization and migration have been going on for part of their 10 billion year lives. By examining our own advanced technology closely, we can get some indications as to how the UFO that kidnapped Travis Walton may have been propelled and how it could have traveled through space to the Earth. The technology to travel to nearby stars in our own galaxy now exists, just as the basic technology to go to the moon existed shortly after World War II. Technological progress is the result of new systems and not perfecting old ones. We cross the Atlantic Ocean 100 times faster now than 200 years ago, not because we've got boats that go 100 times faster, but because we now have jet airliners. Today we take jet airliners for granted, but 200 years ago, they would have sounded like the wildest kind of fantasy. It took Magellan 2 years to sail around the planet, and it only takes a modern astronaut 90 minutes to circle the Earth. The Apollo project not only proved that it was possible for mankind to leave the Earth and visit our nearest neighbor in space, the Moon, it revealed that even the most prestigious scientists often underestimate the ability of human ingenuity to accomplish what is considered impossible. In 1957, Lee DeForest, the inventor of the vacuum tube and father of modern electronics, stated that no matter what the inventions of the future, man would never land on the moon and bring back samples to Earth. Just 12 years after that, millions of people on the Earth were able to watch the first moon landing on television as it happened. When trying to understand UFOs, it is important to be careful about using the word impossible, because the history of our own technology shows that intelligent beings have a habit of accomplishing what was once considered impossible. Today, some people consider it impossible to travel the vast distances between stars. The state of current technology already indicates that their ideas will soon be as obsolete as Mr. DeForest's statement that man would never land on the moon. We could build nuclear-powered starships that could travel in space just the way this submarine travels underwater. These starships could travel to nearby stars and return within the lifetime of a man. They would be powered by nuclear fusion the energy source of the sun, and the same nuclear process used in the hydrogen bomb. An advanced starship, capable of traveling close to the speed of light, could take advantage of Einstein's law of relativity, which has now been experimentally verified. As the spaceship approached the speed of light, the objects that they approach would take on a red glow. Time would begin to slow down for the crew. When they reached 99.999% of the speed of light, they could travel to a star 37 light years away in just 2 months pilot time. The people that they left behind would be 37 years older, but the crew of this starship would have aged only 2 months. The space shuttle will be able to lift portions of a giant nuclear fission or fusion rocket into orbit around the Earth where it could be assembled. From there, it could be launched to other solar systems. The space shuttle will also be used to build and supply space stations. Astronauts have already stayed in space for 5 months. We are rapidly approaching a time when there will be a permanent space colony, and there will always be Earthlings in space. Civilization on Earth is destined to become a space traveling culture, and our space age is less than 25 years old. Who could possibly estimate the technological limits of a space traveling culture that is a billion years older than our own? This UFO caused severe static on the photographer's transistor radio as it maneuvered overhead. Reports of UFOs causing magnetic disturbance, such as the interruption of television and radio transmissions and interference with the electrical systems of cars, are common. This electrical interference strongly suggests that at least one UFO atmospheric propulsion system is based on some kind of electromagnetic propulsion. The first successful test of an electromagnetic propulsion system was conducted on Earth in 1966, when this electromagnetic submarine was first demonstrated. It cost only $2,000 to build. Its homemade look is reminiscent of the Wright Brothers airplane. It clearly demonstrates the potential for magnetic propulsion. This electromagnetic submarine moves through the water as a result of electromagnetic forces. It has absolutely no moving parts. Ionized air is an electrically conductive substance, just like seawater. This film was taken from a space capsule returning to Earth. It shows air ionized by the extreme heat of re-entry. The glowing ionized air seen around the space capsule is very similar to the glowing effect photographed around UFOs and described by UFO witnesses. UFOs may be propelled by some sort of advanced electromagnetic system that is foreshadowed by this primitive submarine, just as Goddard's rockets foreshadowed this advanced rocket. The Travis Walton case is not the only well-documented instance of a person being abducted by a UFO. These books record many such cases. Perhaps the best-known abduction of all, and one of the earliest reported, is the abduction of a well-respected New England couple, Betty and Barney Hill. Barney Hill died in February of 1969, 8 years after their UFO experience on September 20th, 1961. Their experience has been described in a book, The Interrupted Journey, and a movie, The UFO Incident. Betty and Barney Hill were driving along a deserted road at 2 o'clock in the morning on their way to their New Hampshire home from Montreal.
Suddenly, we began to see a strange light in the sky, which was maneuvering in a very erratic pattern. This light began flying along beside us and did this for about 30 miles until we came to an area known as Indian Head. And at that place, this light left the top of the mountain, came out over the highway, and stopped in midair directly in front of us. Barney jumped out of the cab with the binoculars in an attempt to try to identify this craft. Because we knew nothing about UFOs at the time. Barney walked towards it, looking up through the binoculars, and he could see a red light on each side and figures standing behind the double row of windows. He panicked and he ran back to the car saying they planned to capture us and we had to get out of there. And we went speeding down the highway. And at that point, we heard beeping sounds and the car vibrated. Now, when we arrived home, we had many puzzles. The tops of Barney's shoes were scuffed. Our watches had stopped functioning. There were highly polished spots in the trunk of the car. But the biggest mystery of all was the fact that it had taken us 7 hours to drive 190 miles.
The Hills reported their sighting of a UFO to nearby Pease Air Force Base. For fear of ridicule, they left out their observation of alien beings. During the next 2 years, Betty Hill was haunted by nightmares, and Barney developed a debilitating ulcer. Fearing that the ulcer and nightmares were rooted in the 2 hours of lost time, the Hills sought the help of Dr. Benjamin Simon, a psychiatrist and expert in regressive hypnosis. Dr. Simon conducted weekly hypnosis sessions with each of the Hills separately. He would induce amnesia in each of the Hills' session to make sure they couldn't discuss or exchange information about what they remembered. After 3 months, a clear picture of their abduction emerged, and Barney's ulcer had been cured. At that point, Dr. Simon played for them a composite tape of all of the sessions, and the Hills found out the truth about the 2 missing hours.
It was at this point, the beings that had been on the craft were now standing in the middle of the road, a dirt road, blocking our way. The car motor stalled. They separated, came up onto each side, took us out of the car, and at that point, I realized that they undoubtedly planned to take us on board. And that even increased my fears. So that actually, by the time we had arrived at the craft, I was fighting. I was in a panic. They just held me.
After Mrs. Hill's examination by the aliens had been completed, she had an opportunity to speak with the leader of the aliens.
When I asked the leader where he was from, I said, I know you're not from this planet. And this is when I saw the star map. It looked almost like I was looking out a window. It had dimension to it. It was about 3 or 4 feet long and about 2 feet high. There were all these balls of light in it. And the leader explained to me that the heavy lines, the places they go all the time or frequently, the broken lines were expeditions. He asked me if I knew where I was on the map. And I told him no, that I knew nothing about astronomy. And so he said if I did not know where I was on the map, then there was no point of trying to explain it to me. I just didn't have the necessary knowledge.
Betty drew the star map she had seen on board the spacecraft, and it appeared in her book. Because there was no indication of which star was the sun, the best way that this map could be interpreted would be to build a large, three-dimensional model of the sun and all the stars near the sun. The one person who decided to take on this difficult task was Marjorie Fish.
When I first started, I expected to find many similar patterns to Betty's drawing.
But exactly the opposite happened. Because of the peculiar spacing of the stars near the sun, it was impossible for Marjorie Fish to find a match of more than four or five of the 12 patterned stars in the star map. Then she began to focus on the stars that were most like the sun and most likely to have planets and life.
Finally, only the very best stars for life were left. And when that happened, I had a 9-point match.
In 1969, a new star catalog came out giving more accurate distances between stars. Marjorie made a new model based on those distances and disregarded all stars except the ones most likely to have planets and life.
The whole pattern stood out, including three background stars. This was a very, very exciting thing for me.
The 15-point match achieved by Marjorie Fish of the Betty Hill star map is unique and goes far beyond the laws of chance.
Despite the fact that Marjorie Fish tried thousands of different combinations of stars to try to match Betty's pattern, she was able to find one and only one pattern that matched angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn. The star pattern makes sense from nearest star to nearest star to nearest star. The sun is part of the pattern. Quite remarkably, every one of the stars in the pattern is the right kind for planets and life. And all of the right kind of stars for planets and life in this volume of space are part of the pattern. The chance of that happening by accident, all the right kind and only the right kind for patterned stars, is one in several thousand. Perhaps most remarkably, this work tells us where one set of visitors originates. The base stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, are a very special pair of stars.